Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and it is Wednesday, which means it's time for our weekly sports segment with Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Hello, Bill.
Hey, Meghna.
Okay, so it's October, and the Red Sox are back in the postseason, just like last year. They're number three.
I hope not.
No.
Just like last year wasn't so good.
I was going to say, are they going to do better than they did last year?
Well, they can't
do
worse. So that's the positive way to look at it. They can't do any worse.
Okay. Well, this is kind of painful, but let's remind folks to the end of the series last year where the Sox had to bow out.
The roar from the Fenway faithful for Ortiz. Bradley and Pedroia, the runners. Here it comes. Fly ball. Shallow right. Chisenhall. Cleveland wins, and the Indians are headed to the American League Championship Series. They have swept the Boston Red Sox.
So, not exactly the way David Ortiz hoped to bow out.
No.
But do you think, I mean, this year, though, I've been seeing that the Sox have been wearing shirts with the slogan, October ready, so come on. Why not?
Because my experience, and I realize I'm going up against no less an authority than the manager of the Boston Red Sox in saying this, but my experience is that professional athletes are generally ready, no matter how young they are. They've had a lot of seasoning. They've been in the minor leagues for a long time. They have visualized what it's like to be on the big stage in October, and they generally are ready. There may be some specific exceptions to that rule, but I don't think wearing T-shirts that say October ready is going to make a whole lot of difference. Pitching will make a difference if whoever starts each of those games is, in fact, ready to throw a lot of strikes and, not walk guys and throw meatballs at them. Then they'll win.
Okay, so I take your point. Like, these are professionals. They've had a lot of experience. But on the other hand, in terms of postseason experience, I do think there's something to, having younger players who may not have experienced the particular kinds of stresses and pressures that come with postseason play.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. But and in some circumstances, you could probably make a stronger case. But Fenway Park is full of people most nights. The Red Sox are on television. They're often on national television. There are a zillion writers in the clubhouse and TV people and radio people every night. Yes, the postseason is different because there's a brighter spotlight, but these guys are not completely unaware of what it means to have a lot of people paying attention to what they're doing.
Okay. All right. I'll grant you that. So let's switch gears and talk about another team that has a lot of people pay attention to what they're doing.
And not happy about it.
No, not happy about it. The Patriots, they face Tampa tomorrow night. But how's the season, in your mind, been going so far? We're in week five here.
Well, the Patriots have demonstrated one of the cruel realities of the game of football, which is it doesn't matter how often and how easily you score if the other team is also scoring often and easily, and if at the end of the game the other team has done that more often than you have. And
yeah,
the Patriots have experienced that a couple of times, and they've been very close to experiencing it on other occasions as well. I don't think anybody saw this coming. I think all the predictions by people much wiser than I am about football were that the Patriots were a very complete team, that Tom Brady was going to be fine, and that the defense was going to be fine, and they were making, as you well know, projections of an undefeated season. I don't think anybody saw the defense being as porous as it has been at the beginning of the season.
Right, and it is a surprise, especially given what you were saying a bit earlier about that truism of sport, that no matter how many points you score, if the other team scores more, they're going to win.
Absolutely.
But Brady's actually having a pretty great season so
absolutely
far.
Absolutely.
At the decrepit, I don't know if I can say that because I am around his age, but age of 40, I mean,
I can't even remember his age. Life begins at 40 for pro quarterbacks, apparently, yeah, or actually continues at 40 in Tom Brady's case, because he said lots of other great years as well.
Well, it's all that water he drinks
every
day.
Maybe that's it.
The electrolytes. No, but I mean, no interceptions so far, leading the league in passing yards. He's also even been hit quite a lot.
Yeah, if only he could play safety. Play some defense. We would return to the age of the two-way football player.
Okay. Well, so let's hope that defensively the Pats get their act together here pretty soon. Let's switch now to the world of World Cup soccer, because there's a big game coming up for Team USA. And I should say, we're talking about the men here, right?
We are this time around, yes.
Okay.
And it is a big game because the U.S. men's team is on the brink of failing to qualify for the World Cup next year in Russia. And I don't know if anybody really quite expected that to be such a tense situation at this point either. We'd reached the point perhaps, or many soccer fans at least, had reached the point where they anticipated that the U.S. would qualify pretty much automatically out of CONCACAF. It's not the world's most competitive group. Boy, they better beat Panama on Friday night.
Mm. Now, if I have my standings right here, they're tied with Honduras with 9 points in the CONCACAF standings now?
Correct.
Okay. And those two teams tied last month, and that was due to when they last faced off, it was due to a last-second goal. I just love the sound of the soccer call, so let's hear it.
Well, it was a Clint Mathis free kick a couple of ago. That one blasted and slapped away by Lopez as it almost found the net. Still loose in front, and it's knocked home by Bobby Wood. Clint Dempsey creates, but it's Wood that finishes and levels in the 85th.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a good call. It's not a great
call. No, it's definitely nowhere near the great
one. Because the great call
ones.
Is always on Univision.
Yeah.
And it goes something like this. Goal! And it doesn't end so quickly because it isn't determined by how much time we have left in the program.
We have 23 seconds left. Do it again. Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game, which you can hear right here on 90.9 WBR every Saturday at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. And he's also the station's biggest football fan. Bill, thanks so much.
Goal, Magnet.
This week, we're bringing you excerpts of Modern Love, the podcast. It's a production of WBUR and the New York Times, and I am lucky enough to host it. So today, our excerpt features Cynthia Nixon. She's a Tony winner for her performance in the Broadway drama The Little Foxes, and you probably also know her from Sex and the City. Here she is reading Mary Alice Hostetter's Modern Love essay, Dear Dad, We've Been Gay for a Really Long Time.
The first letter was not mine. Although my brother Charles and I had spent so much time talking about it that I felt some ownership. I was in San Francisco for the Thanksgiving holiday, and we had read and reread the letter he was planning to send to my father, changing a word here and there, rearranging sentences. I suggested he replace gay with homosexual, the word my father was more likely to have heard, usually in the same sentence with abomination, from the pulpit of the Mennonite church he and my mother had attended for decades. I was supportive of my brother, respected his courage, and was flattered that he valued my opinion about something so important, but I didn't fully understand. "You really think he needs to know?" I asked. "How is this going to help him?" "It's not for him," Charles said. "I'm doing this for me. I'm over 60 years old, and he still thinks I'll get married if I find the right woman." "It's not like he's rejected you," I said. "He thinks the sun rises and sets on his doctor sons." "I don't know what he'll do with this, but I need him to know who I am." I told my partner later, "Charles is obsessed with that letter." "Seems like it's important to him for your father to know," she said. "I think our father is doing the best he can," I said. "He never went beyond eighth grade, and he's been a farmer his whole life. His world's pretty narrow. He's 95. Something like this? No telling how he'll take it." "You may as well let it go," she said. The next morning, my brother asked if I wanted to walk with him to the mailbox. The sun was glistening off the buildings on the San Francisco skyline against a brilliant blue sky. We walked to Fillmore, and I watched him drop the letter into the mailbox slot. "There it goes," he said. "No taking it back now," I said. We took the long way home, through Alamo Square Park, the iconic painted ladies lined up in the morning light. "I wonder who'll visit first after he gets the letter," my brother said. "Who'll get to process it with him?" Two of our eight brothers lived near his nursing home in Pennsylvania and checked in on him every week. "I know Abe goes every Wednesday afternoon," I said, "and I think Ike goes on Friday." Abe is a psychiatrist, Ike a retired farmer and Mennonite deacon. There are 12 of us siblings altogether. "Doubt it'll get there by Wednesday," my brother said. My partner and I flew back to Virginia, and the busyness of catching up at work and preparing for the holidays distracted me from wondering when the news would hit the family grapevine. It didn't take long before the reports started trickling in. Each tidbit so remarkable, I began to keep a record so I wouldn't forget. Ike, the farmer brother, was the first one my father showed the letter to. "Did you know this?" my father asked. "Everyone pretty much knows it." "I sure didn't," my father said. "Had no idea." By the following Wednesday, when Abe visited, my father had more questions. "How does this happen?" Abe said, "Seems some people are just born that way." "Are a lot of them born that way?" "About 1 in 10, they estimate." "Well, if it's how people are born, it sure doesn't seem like something that should tear families apart." That proclamation rippled up and down the family grapevine, and it seemed it should echo down the halls of Fairmont Nursing Home, past the nurses' stations, and across the fields to the plain brick Mennonite churches. After my father received and processed my brother's letter, he seemed to spend a good deal of time in his sunny room contemplating this new reality. It was clear he gave some thought to the 1 in 10 theory, and from his vantage point overlooking the nursing home entrance, he counted off visitors, wondering. He talked to visiting family members about unmarried relatives, neighbors. When my younger brother Sanford visited, my father said, "You know, I've been thinking about Eli." Eli was an Amish neighbor. All those years he worked that farm by himself. "I remember when he was younger, he dated girls, but it didn't work out for him. I wonder if that was the story with Eli. Makes me feel bad that he never found someone." And then the question started about me. "It makes me wonder about Mary Alice," my father said. "What about her?" "I guess you should ask her," Sanford said. Of course, my father wasn't going to. It wasn't the sort of thing we would talk about. When Sanford told me about the conversation, I knew it was time to clear things up, to let my father know that I was part of the 1 in 10. I could have dispatched a sibling to deliver my news. I could have shouted it to my hearing-impaired father over the phone or on my next visit. A letter seemed like the most reliable way to communicate. After my brother's courageous letter, I knew mine would be anticlimactic, not only because my brothers came first, but also because I was one of four daughters, and in our family, especially from my father's point of view, nothing about being a daughter appeared to have the same import as it would have from a son. So I wrote my letter and sent it. But during my next visit, the subject never came up. My father was as welcoming to my partner and me as he always had been. I considered asking him about the letter, but never did. Had my mother still been alive, I think the conversation would have been outsourced to her. They had lived at the nursing home together for a couple of years before she died at 95. Just a few weeks after they celebrated their 74th anniversary. For years after she died, my father glanced toward her chair when he needed to tell her something, and I'm sure he would have liked to know what she thought of the letters. I can only hope she would have been as understanding as my father was. But I'll never know. The nursing home where my parents lived was run by conservative Mennonites and was consistently recognized for the quality of its care and its cleanliness. Many of the staff members considered their work a religious calling. A steady stream of volunteers cleaned the residents' eyeglasses, shined their shoes, massaged feet, and filled the halls and chapels with music. My father ate his meals in the main dining hall, but insisted on a full-size refrigerator in his room to store his Turkey Hill black cherry ice cream, which my brothers made sure he always had. He kept the bowls and spoons in the refrigerator, along with pretzels and pink mints for the children. He served himself a snack each evening. As one of only a handful of men in the nursing home, my father was much sought after by the widows. He made it clear that he had no intention of remarrying, but he did invite some of them over for a bowl of ice cream now and then. His vision of heaven included reuniting with our mother. Although he was longing for that time, he first wanted to live to be 100, or at the very least, live longer than his older brother, who had died just short of 99. In time, my father's focus on who was or wasn't gay abated. The reality blended into the landscape of carefully tended farms, stretching as far as he could see from his nursing home window. Sometimes I like to imagine him sitting in the sunroom with the three other men in his wing, all of them hard of hearing, him shouting, "And I have two children who are gay. What do you make of that?" My father died 10 years ago, a week short of his 100th birthday. I think it gave him peace knowing all 12 of his children had found someone with whom to share their lives. If he's with my mother in heaven, I hope he has brought her up to date on family news. If he's run into Eli up there, his Amish neighbor, I expect he's told him how sorry he is that he had to work the farm by himself all those years. Recently, many of the Mennonite churches in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, decided to split from Mennonite Church USA, which has chosen to allow openly gay members. The only thing as important as church to my parents was family. I'm glad they didn't live to see this time. Would church or family win? Would my father speak up against his church to tell people, "It's not the sort of thing to tear families apart"? Last May, after 18 years together, my longtime partner and I married. I don't know what my parents would have made of that. But I wish they could have been there.
Cynthia Nixon, reading Mary Alice Hostetter's modern love essay, "Dear Dad, We've Been Gay for a Really Long Time." Now, as part of the Modern Love podcast, we usually follow up with the actors to see why they chose a particular essay to read for us. And so we asked Cynthia why she read this one. And she says that the stoicism of the father in Hostetter's piece really appealed to her.
My mother's family is from Missouri. And I always remember when my mother started seeing a man that she was eventually with for almost 35 years who was Jewish, when she talked to her great aunt, who was like a second mother to her, she was curious to know whether my great-aunt would have any negative reaction to that. And my great-aunt Edna sort of scrunched up her face and said, oh, there's so much more important things than that kind of thing to worry about. And that my great-aunt's attitude and her proclamation to me echoed the patriarch's sentiment. And I think there is running through middle America that kind of people making up their mind and not making a fuss and having what we would consider a degree of enlightenment, but it's just sort of practical common sense, too. Why would we worry about such a thing?
Thanks again to Cynthia Nixon for reading this Modern Love essay for us. And if you liked what you heard here, and I really hope you did, subscribe to the Modern Love Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your long-form, on-demand listening experiences. Of course, you should also have Radio Boston's podcast there in your queue as well. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Kathleen McNerney, Jamie Bologna, and Allison Bruzek. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.